Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Platinum VIP Terminal. Experience private check-in, suites for relaxation, and then chauffeur-driven to your aircraft.
Welcome to Playback. It is a scorcher.
Temperatures this weekend could be close to the record set almost 150 years ago. Met Aaron has forecast highs in the low 30s in some areas. The record 33.3 degrees was set at Kilkenny Castle in 1887.
Enjoy it. Off walk, just enjoy it while we can, innit? Like, yeah, brilliant, you know. Enjoy the view. A nice barbecue now later on and happy days. Chill out.
Oh, well, I love the sun coming out to say hello because I swim every day and I've had four swims now today in Sandy Cove, and so I'm very happy.
It's brilliant, it is, yeah, and it gets the crowds out, and it's great to see the lot of young kids out as well, jumping in the 40 foot and enjoying the weather.
Puts everyone in such a good mood, though, doesn't it?
Seldom is wonderful, but it does, yeah, it does. Puts a lot of smiles, even a smile on your own face.
My son's in Palma at the moment for Santa Ponsa on the Leaving Cert holiday, having great fun. Hello, Barry Collins. Anyway, but he said it's so warm there, but it's been heating up there for months and weeks, and it's the Mediterranean. It's
sure,
smaller.
He's hardly seen daylight, I'd say, has he? Since
maybe
he arrived?
Not. I don't know. We'll see when he comes home.
I mean, we can see here families. You know, everybody's got a smile on their face when the sun is out in Ireland.
Super, it's fantastic. It really lifts everyone's spirit.
Now, will you tell me about the famous ice cream sandwiches?
My little shop is only a corrugated iron shed, as you know. And the heat of the sun, we're passing out here.
Everybody is smiling.
And everybody is so happy. What a wonderful place to work.
What do you love about this beautiful weather that we're having at the moment?
All the weirdos it brings out. Well, we just got asked what was it, take our photo. 100 beautiful girls for Instagram. It was a scam.
How do you know?
Because she was trying to get money. As
I said, it's great to see the young people out walking with babies and all. It is great to see them.
You like sitting in the sun and doing nothing. Just sitting in the sun, that's all.
Oh, but we are having the weather. I hope you are lapping it up, and those vox pops from Joe Caulfield on Morning Ireland and Brian O'Connell at Fountainstown Beach in Cork. And if you're heading to the seaside, ice cream for all. But do watch out for the weaver fish. They were everywhere this week. And in public service broadcasting news, people, we're here to keep you sting-free with Claire, Ken O'Sullivan, underwater cinematographer, and Lola O'Sullivan, no relation, from Water Safety Ireland. And she's a volunteer down in Waterford. And warming oceans means we're encountering more of these little fishies earlier in the summer.
They would only really be predominant in August, but with the changing weather, they are more predominant now. We actually had a lady from Tipperary last week who literally got out of her car on Tremore Beach. The tide was low. She went down to do exactly as you said, to paddle in the water, and she got stung by a weaver fish.
Ah, right. And how did that go? Explain to us what happened.
So she felt, she didn't know what was after happening. So she thought she was after standing on a piece of glass, and she got on her feet and the pain started getting worse and worse, and she checked it and there was nothing there. And of course, Tremore Beach is a lifeguarded beach. So the minute she said it to the lifeguards, they recognised it as a weaver fish and they began to treat it.
So what does that involve?
It's a very simple solution, and people are a bit amazed at how simple it is. You put your foot in water and you heat the water until it gets to really as warm as you can possibly bear, and that literally breaks down the venom.
But you have to be careful, and I was reading about this morning, because the bite can make your foot feel numb, so you mightn't realise how hot it is. So I just saw some advice this morning that you should put the 2 feet in so that at least one foot knows the water's getting too hot.
So we would normally start them off with tepid water and then gradually add and add and add.
Duly noted. But for Ken O'Sullivan, we might be looking at this whole thing from a skewed perspective.
Ken, now you give us the science bit about this little nasty fella, the weaver fish.
I wouldn't describe him as that. So
No, he is. Full so stop. It's a nasty thing.
Yeah, they buried themselves in the sand, as Lola said, and they're usually a little bit out. So we mostly would encounter them at low tide. And the time to be very careful is at low spring tide, when the water is lower and you're more likely to be in their territory. Now, I have to say, they're not stinging us. They're not attacking us. We're walking on them. And they have a little self-protective spine on their dorsal fin, the one at the top, and that has some venom in there. But thankfully, I haven't been stung for years because somebody gave me wonderful advice years ago, drag your feet. So they're always on sandy bottoms. Drag your feet as soon as you get into the water. Just, you know, just drag them along. They'll feel you coming and they'll either get out of the way or they'll bury themselves down into the sand.
Isn't that a great little
hint? Very, very simple.
Because I had decided that everybody was wearing shoes now in the water for this summer.
Well, you can do. You get neoprene socks or neoprene boots. Absolutely, you can. Mm-hmm. But that's the simplest thing. And look.
Oh, just drag your feet. That's all well and good. But tell it to Celine. She'd gotten the weaver fish sting, no crack, and spoke to Brendan Courtney in for Oliver. She's from Mayo, by the way.
Well, I was swimming in my local beach, so I was out in waist-deep water just coming out, and then I thought I stood on a stone, but mm-hmm. I just felt this pain on my heel. And when I popped out, I said, oh, I'd walk this off, you know, but the pain just started to creep up the back of my leg.
Oh.
So I hopped into the car and drove up to Doherty's there in Mulranny. It's a little gala shop.
I love Ireland.
And I went in limping, sort of sweating, wiping the sweat from my brow.
Go on.
And there was people in front of me ordering ice cream cones. And I was going, oh, good Lord, just hurry up. And so I looked at the girl behind the counter and I said, I think I stood. And she went, oh, you're the first one of the year, in you come. So out she came then with a Mayo bucket with hot water in it and put me underneath the crisp display station.
What's a Mayo bucket? Hang on. You have a special bucket of Mayo?
A special Mayo bucket, yeah, a mayonnaise bucket.
Oh, a mayonnaise bucket.
That my foot will fit into. So I sat there with my foot in a mayonnaise bucket in the mayonnaise. Middle of the shop in Mulranny. Underneath the crisps for an hour with my foot in hot water.
With the shop owner rolling her eyes going, there's the first one of the season.
There's the first one of the season, but the relief was instant.
That's
absolutely
great.
Instant.
Well, Celine, you're my Sir Weaver. Thank you so much. Thanks for taking the call. You're making us feel terrified.
Thank
now.
You very much,
to think it happened in Mayo. Drag those feet. Sport aplenty again this weekend, but we will take a wee moment for a sure radio highlight from last weekend. Yes, it was the hurling semi-final, Tip versus Kilkenny. Yes, we know about the controversy, the score, who knew what when, but let's put it aside and take a listen to this.
Chasing everything, wonderful heroics, ball inside the end, the idea was right, going after his ocean and Dunno, nipping in, Kilkenny are diving in the ball, heroic, ball is skipping away, Tipperary have the ball, there's an opportunity here, can they get inside, is there a free, the referee is there, a straight,
oh my god,
of the ages, a goal to win an All-Ireland final place, my word! A croak packed of a lad. This is incredible. Incredible. 14 man Tipperary.
Mowdy! It was Noel McGrath. I got it. The devs of flicks. And it was Oisin O'Donnell. I've seen he's going for the point. He backs himself top corner. Oh my word. What an incredible goal by Oisin O'Donnell. And what an incredible finish to this match.
What a goal to beat one of the best keepers. Nicky Quaid and Owen Murphy have dominated the All-Stars. It takes a class act, a class shot, an absolute rasper to hit the back of the Kilkenny net. And Tipperary down to 14 players, down because Darren McCarthy was sent off in a second yellow. And they're now 32 points to 29. Four goals and 20 points to 29 points. 3 points between them. Tipperary are playing like men obsessed from in front of the Cusack staff. They've gone wild in Tipperary. The ball has gone wide. We're gone wild in the commentary box, but it's hard to blame us. The puck out is quickly taken.
A flick by Mal, a flick by Noel McGrath. It was a kind of a little deftest flick. 4 minutes. Barry O'Neill has told us there's 4 minutes on the clock. There's
a good hurling man from Ballyshannon.
There's still time. These boys are striving men. They're not being until they're gone down the motorway, Marty. I'm telling you, we've been here before.
And you know it well, John Milan. You've never been to Kenny until they're on the bus, or you're on the bus.
Marty Morrissey, John Milan, the sheer joy of the game. And in this week's race for the big house, yesterday, finally, we got ourselves the first confirmed contender. Sandra Hurley.
Independent TD Catherine Connolly has emerged as a likely left-wing candidate in the presidential race, as she seems well on her way to securing the backing of the necessary 20 Oireachtas members in order to run. She said today that her mind was made up and that she had support from across the spectrum. The Social Democrats says its 11 Oireachtas members will back Miss Connolly, saying she has been a tireless advocate for progressive causes. The Labour Party has invited Miss Connolly to address its parliamentary party next week, and it's understood that the leadership is of the view that it is positive that a left-wing candidate is emerging. People Before Profit is also likely to back the Galway West TD. Next week, Fine Gael is expected to confirm Mairead McGuinness as its candidate, as the presidential contenders begin to emerge.
It is on. And all of this in a week when some ruled themselves out and others ruled nothing out.
We're in this process and we're not ruling anything in or anything out. And as and when we have news for you around our own process and procedure and all the runners and riders, I've seen lots of people's names mentioned. So... We're not making any comment definitively on any of them, myself included.
Myself included, Sinn Féin's Mary Lou MacDonald on Monday. Paul Cunningham spoke to Rachel on the News at One.
Paul, there's an awful lot of rune reading going on at the moment. What should we read into Mary Lou MacDonald's remarks, do you think?
Well, I think it's interesting because in March, she told journalists, "It won't be me," when asked if she could be a presidential candidate. And now she's moved from that negative into a maybe, saying, "I'm not ruling anything in and I'm not ruling anything out." If she was to stand, and there's a big question mark there, she is a very capable politician. She's very good on the election stump and she would be a very strong candidate. So once that shift in position happened, everyone's ears pricked up at Leinster House. Could it be that the president and leader of Sinn Féin is in the running for the Oireachtas? We don't know. But what's happening at the moment is that Sinn Féin is trying to determine, and that's what the consultation with the membership has been, but she's got a final report on her desk since Saturday, as to whether or not Sinn Féin should put forward their own candidate or Sinn Féin should back the other left-wing parties and have an agreed candidate. So that's the first decision they have to take. And if it was that Sinn Féin decides to go on its own path, well, then the next question is it going to be Mary Lou MacDonald?
And then on Thursday's Morning Ireland, a decision to opt out.
Sean Kelly, Fine Gael MEP. Are you going to be a candidate to be the next President of Ireland?
Reluctantly, I have to say I will not be. I have given it a lot of consideration. It's probably the most difficult decision I've had to make, certainly in my political life. But I looked at the pros and cons and I asked myself one question. I said, am I happy with what I'm doing at the moment? And I said, I am. Would I be happier spending 7 years in the Oireachtas, considering John B. Keane said a day out of Kerry is a day wasted? And I said, perhaps not. So I looked at all the pros and cons and I'm very disappointed in some respects because it's only something that comes along once in a lifetime and an awful lot of TDs and supporters within Fine Gael and outside Fine Gael were anxious for me to run and to support me. But ultimately, I had to make up my own mind, having consulted with my family, who were 100% behind whatever decision I was willing to take. But I think the best thing is, at this point in time, to continue the work I've been doing in Europe. I got a massive vote.
So some are out and some are in, but it is on. Now, after all that, how about a little bit of Philip Glass? Kate Ellis of Crash Ensemble joined Sean on Arena to talk about their performance of Glassworks.
I don't know if he was kind of specifically looking to marry pop and classical, but he was certainly looking to grab a new audience for what might have been considered art music at the time.
Yeah, so he'd had a lot of success with sort of larger scale orchestral and opera, some of his operas. And he wanted to write something that would be more accessible to a wider audience. So it was actually intended, the piece Glassworks was actually intended as a studio recording and it was released in 1982, I think, as both an LP and as a cassette. So the LP and the cassette each had their own separate mix, with the LP sort of intended for home listening and the cassette with a specific headphone mix, which was intended for Walkmans, which were kind of all the rage at the time.
Oh, they were the big thing in the 80s. The idea that you could walk around with these headphones on and listen to music was totally new, a totally new idea. But I wanted to play the Philip Glass Ensemble themselves, playing a little bit of one of my favourite movements from the work, so I'm just being selfish on this one, Flow, which has such excitement within it, I think, and also really shows off the wind section of the ensemble. Never be fooled by a slow opening. It doesn't mean that it's going to stay that way. That's a little section from Flow.
And that on a Walkman in 1982. Amazing. Back in a bit. Welcome back.
Procrastination.
Ah, yes. Let's put off until tomorrow that which we could do today. But don't worry, you're not alone.
Is it just not part of the human condition?
It is. I mean, we all procrastinate. And I guess it's different levels of procrastination. You put off little decisions and then you put off big ones. I guess the problematic forms of procrastination is you're longing to do something. You've always wanted to quit the day job, Ray, and join the circus, but you just haven't found the courage to do it and follow your dream. And what's stopping you from doing that? Well, that sort of procrastination is a more serious one. But you're right, it is kind of part of the human nature. And I think there's some unhealthy kind of forms of kind of dwelling on procrastination, like it's a big problem. It's just something to cope with. You live with procrastination. We live with indecision. We live with unsatisfied desires. And, you know, there is maybe... before we kind of talk about how to cure procrastination, maybe there's sometimes an over-focus on this being a problem, that, you know, something wrong with you if you procrastinate. It's nothing wrong with you. It's very human.
Joe Humphreys with the Darcy. Yes, it may be human, but it doesn't feel great. That nagging sensation that you're behind, not quite there, not living your best life, as the kids might say. And Humphreys talked about the work of psychotherapist Adam Phillips.
He says, you know, we spend a lot of our lives kind of thinking the myth of potential, that we had this potential to be something different. We're not living our real lives. Somehow our real life is elsewhere. It's just out of touch. And if we just change a few things, we'd get there. But actually, you are living your life. That's it. This is your life. And we spend a lot of time thinking about this other life, the unlived life that is just non-existent. So let's dwell on the real life.
Why do we focus in on this unlived life, or this dream job, or running away with the circus, or what we could have been, what should have been, blah, blah, blah? Why do we do that?
Yeah, well, Phillips, one of his theories is that it's because when we're kids, we're told we're special and brilliant, and then we've grown up, we realise we're not. And we realise what happened to our special, brilliant selves. We're not geniuses. We're not like exceptional in the sense of other eyes. We're not like held up a podium. But we're brilliant in other ways, like we're in our own terms.
Of course we are, on our own terms. But if you do want to get off the manana treadmill, here are some ideas.
One is to lower the stakes of change, and the other is to raise the stakes
of
the status quo.
Of them.
So lowering the stakes of change. So it really, it's one of the things that stops us from changing. We think, oh, there's going to be a big cost here, maybe a financial impact, or, you know, someone's
going to... Say like leaving your job to pursue a hobby.
So suppose there's a practical thing there. You might say, okay, well, let's say I tried for 6 months. Is there a way I can live on less money? Can I survive on less? So that's kind of a practical thing. I think one of the big things that stops us from changing is people's opinion. You know, we're afraid of what other people will think if we quit our job and do something ludicrous or join a monastery or whatever. So, and it's public opinion that is really huge pressure. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the French philosopher, says we live in the shadow of other people's opinions. And there's a constant, so you're thinking, well, will I be letting down my mother, my parents, will I be letting down, you know, what my work peers think about this? Another good thinker, a modern kind of writer on this, American academic Brené Brown writes on this, and she writes a lot about resilience and guilt that people carry in life. And she says we must have the courage to love ourselves even when we risk disappointing others. And it's that idea of disappointing other people, you have to do it. I mean, we should, you know, so if there's one kind of message from lowering the stakes, you know, be a disappointment. Disappoint your parents, disappoint your colleagues, you know, you can't satisfy everyone and don't right. be trying to, you know,
so live
your life.
The stakes. How do you higher the stakes? What,
so
where higher does that
the
work?
Stakes. So the flip side of that is kind of saying, well, there's a philosopher, Simon May, who's written a book called Jump about conquering procrastination. And he says, you know, channel the power of regret. So it's kind of the idea that if you don't do something, imagine going through life and say yes, you never yes. did the thing
it's
you really
that,
wanted to
line,
do.
It's that line that on your deathbed, you'll regret the things you didn't do as opposed to the things you did.
Exactly. So there's a kind of a healthy way here.
And of course, it being the Dorothy, we got this.
I think about death every day. I don't know if you do.
Well, actually, Transpired Humphreys did. A kindred spirit. He has a little skull on his desk as a memento mori.
It's a Latin for a memorial of death or a memento of death. So you have a...
It's just a reminder that,
a reminder of death.
That you'll die.
Yeah, exactly. Thinking about old age, dying, death. What, you know, what are
depressing.
We part of something bigger?
It's depressing.
It is depressing.
It's not, I'm
well,
just saying
it
people
can and
say
can't.
That.
That's the point. I think the point is to find a balance between despair and kind of, you know, being frozen by sort of the impending death. You know, you can find positive ways to think about it.
Joe Humphreys with Ray. And if the skull on the desk doesn't work for you, try heading to the cinema and screaming. Here's Dr. Sarah Cleary. Oh, she describes herself as a horror consultant.
Do we know what it is about us that we want to sit there with our hands over our faces?
Oh, absolutely.
What need does it, what itch does it scratch?
What itch does it scratch? I think it scratches a lot of needs for us. I suppose on the surface level, we revel in this idea of the vulnerability of self, because you suppress an awful lot of the fact that you're going to die, that you're vulnerable, that you're a bag of guts walking around the place. You'd never be able to go to Tesco. You'd be paralysed saying, oh my God, I can't cross the road. And what horror does is it taps into us and say, here, come here, you now. You know the way you think you're a big fella with your job and your mortgage and your life and your marriage and your fancy car? You are just a vulnerable sack of guts. And we kind of revel in that idea. And it's this idea of memento mori. But it also taps into emotional, complex, unspoken and sometimes intangible feelings that we have about what it means to be human, what it means to be alive in the world.
And if you're finding yourself drawn to the menace in the basement, the creatures in the attic, the monster under the bed, it might be because, as Claire put it, horror is having a moment. And this might be down to geopolitics.
Quite frankly, I think horror is one of the most robust and dynamic forms of social commentary that we have out there. We can engage in the subtext of so many films, and sometimes it's more overt than others. But we deal with really, really complex themes in a really safe way. So it's kind of almost like a safe space to explore unsafe themes. And I think that when you create a really banging horror film that has all the entertainment aspects to it and people can engage with it in the popcorn fun way, but it also has a really strong message, arguably that message is more powerful sometimes than a documentary or somebody giving a speech, mm-hmm. because it's the spoonful of sugar with the really, really strong messaging behind it.
And it might be the job of horror to remind us of our fragility. And we're back again to the skull on the desk.
Everyone thinks horror is about blood and guts and darkness and monsters. And what it's actually doing is holding a mirror up to us and saying, guys, memento mori, remember you're going to die. So make sure you live and make sure that you care about your fellow man.
Ooh, alive in the world until we're not, or we morph into flesh-eating zombies. The lengths we will go to distract from the inevitable. But if you were curious as to what might lie on the far side, Monday's Liveline with Philip brought us Liam. He'd collapsed on the football pitch.
How long were you dead?
Well, I thought it was about 2 to 3 minutes, but the experts tell me it was more like 5 minutes.
And that brought us to the big questions of the great hereafter. Pearly gates, celestial voices.
I don't mean to be trite asking this, yeah, but, you know, were there bright lights? Were there heavenly choirs of angels, or was it just nothing?
No, I know it sounds strange, but no, absolutely nothing. There are different people who come in to visit me and all. Well, what was it like the other side and all that sort of stuff? And to be honest with you, no, there was nothing like that at all. When I just remembered seeing what I call like a frozen TV picture, that was it. That was all I remembered until I woke up lying beside the ambulance on the pitch.
And before all of this happened, did you believe in the hereafter?
Not really.
Okay. But for you, it was confirmation of what you already suspected, that there's only the big sleep that awaits us.
That's what it appeared like, you know. And, you know, I know it's very morbid to say this, but if someone was to pass away under those circumstances, it's certainly not a bad way to go.
If one must, that was Liam, remarkably sanguine and not a bright light in sight. But if that dashes your dreams, fret not, because Tuesday's Liveline brought us people who'd had a very different near-death experience.
I was on the ceiling, looking down at myself in the bed, totally disconnected from myself in the bed. And I could see myself lying in the bed. There was a priest anointing me. There was a doctor trying to get a pulse. And my husband was holding my hand.
That's Anya. And then she saw a light and there was a feeling.
I remember going through a tunnel. It was very, very peaceful. And I felt as if I was being accompanied. I didn't feel on my own. And I was going towards a beautiful, bright light. And it's the kind of light, you know, a fluorescent light, you know, that colour of white. But a fluorescent light is very harsh on your eyes.
Mm.
But this was that colour, but soft.
How did you feel?
I felt I was heading home. I really felt I couldn't get there fast enough. I felt as if I was nearly in moon boots, you know.
Okay.
I just couldn't get there fast enough.
And was there a part of you that rationalised this and said, I'm dying, this must be what dying is like?
No, I was, I basically was in that moment.
Okay. And it wasn't scary, it was euphoric.
No, it was beautiful and it was so peaceful. And I felt that the light was so gentle and I could see this figure in the light. And I just knew I was going back home.
Who was the figure?
To me, the figure was Jesus, because I would be, I'd go to Mass on Sundays, I'd be a Catholic, but I would be very spiritual. So to me, it looked like Jesus welcoming me home.
And then we heard from Seamus, and he, too, had also been on something of a journey.
While I was in the coma, I'm not sure whether it was in the coma or before or after the operation, I felt like I was floating along in a cloud, kind of a circular cloud. And I met, at the end of the cloud, was my father and mother. I got a bit emotional this morning when I was talking to your researcher about this.
You
and trying to keep myself together with this. I met the two of them. My mother had died in 1980. My father had died in 1984 from a stroke. My mother had died from cancer in 1989. This is minimum 15 years later. They were both, my father, ironically enough, my father had a suit. The only time he wore a suit was going to Mass on Sunday morning, as he was a fisherman. And my mother was sitting on a chair. He was standing over her. and they said, go back. So, after the operation, I just woke up and...
Well, hang on, Seamus, stay with them for a second. Yeah. Was it a conversation or was it a feeling of, I'm just with my parents?
Oh, no. I was floating in the cloud and I just met them in a room. She was sitting on a chair. I remember this as if it was yesterday, you know. Mm. It's kind of weird because this was no dream. Your normal dream, you're like, actually, you forget that the day after. This is as clear to me now as it was then. I'm not a religious person.
Yeah, but what happened here? I mean, was it, hello, ma'am, hello, dad, ah, Shamie, how are you? Or just that simple one exchange, go back?
No, they said to me, go back, your time isn't up.
And back he came and took the call on Liveline. Seamus with Philip. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Sunday with Miriam, Donny O'Sullivan, CNN correspondent from Carers Eivin. His new podcast is called Persuadable, and it's about conspiracy theories, or rather, not so much the theories, but why so many of us are so eager to believe them.
I spent some time with a group in Dallas who were essentially a cult, who had believed not only that JFK Jr., but that JFK himself was some way going to come back, was going to reincarnate. And so I think in some ways we can get distracted by just how crazy the beliefs are and forget about the people who believe them. Mm. And, you know, if you sort of just laugh at people and say, oh, they're a lost cause, well, then they're going to remain a lost cause. So in the podcast, we tried to get people to unlock their own empathy. And that could be a very difficult thing, especially when you have, you know, again, dealing with these sort of crazy beliefs. And for me, you know, I started to think, well, we all have superstitions. We all believe something crazy or have at some point in our lives or have had false belief or irrational thoughts. In my case, it's mental health. It's beliefs I have about myself when I'm in a sort of pit of depression or anxiety, which I spoke about a bit before, but, you know, I've been kind of struggling with that on and off 15 years now. And I've been in places in my mind where, you know, you're just not thinking straight. And a lot of it is motivated by fear or something has gone wrong in your life and things aren't working out. And then you are trying, you know, as the mind tries to get control of things, you're going down this sort of rabbit hole in your own mind. And I think that's what a lot of people I meet who are really into these wild conspiracy theories, it's a release for them. It's their way of coping.
And he talked about all our need for connection and belonging and how sometimes that can make us particularly vulnerable.
And you just sort of see that click, right? And that's where they go off, the sort of deep end into irrationality. And over time, I started to sort of kind of recognize that. I was like, that I've experienced that click, that sort of second where you just things change, and that for me was sort of the reckoning with my own mental health. It's sort of the podcast came about over the course of a few years of figuring that out. And you know, I'm not in any way trying to say that everybody who believes in sort of conspiracy theories have mental illness, because that's not the case, or any mental health difficulties. Mm. And you don't need to have that to engage in this sort of thinking. I merely bring up mental health because of my own experience. It was my way to sort of unlock empathy. And look, really what we found in a lot of these groups is people are either looking for meaning, they're looking for community, they want to be part of something. You know, I think we underestimate sometimes how good it feels. It's good to be in a cult for a while, at least. You know, like it's good to join a group like that, because you have all of a sudden you have community and meaning, and you have all these important reasons to be around, and you believe in something. Of course, oftentimes then it goes off
the deep end.
Yeah.
And then Miriam asked him about a particularly private clip he plays as part of the podcast.
So in the third episode, you play a very raw clip. I think you've saved a folder in your phone that's in it. What What is happening in that clip and why did you decide to share it?
Yeah. It's from 3 or 4 years ago and I was sort of in a fairly bad place. I think it was maybe 2022 or so, but just went through a sort of 5 or 6 months of just sort of depression and things like that. And I don't know, I for some reason one day I took a brief sort of selfie video of myself on just crying, which is sort of a weird thing to do. But the reason I did it was that I wanted to have it to sort of to show myself in the future that that you know, I've been there and I'll come back out of it, because I do always come back out of it. And yeah, I had forgotten about it. And it was really, you know, we kind of spent 6 months making this podcast, but it was only in the last week that I plucked up the courage to tell my producers about it, and we put it in. I actually haven't watched or listened back to it at all since, because it's quite difficult, but it's essentially just me sobbing. It's quite quite sad. But I just eventually thought, we ask a lot of people as journalists to open up. And, you know, obviously journalism is changing and how people connect with stories are changing. So I obviously there would be a time where, you know, you wouldn't probably put yourself into the story like that. But, you know, I thought it was helpful in this regard.
Donny O'Sullivan on Sunday with Miriam. And on the prompt, writer Belinda McKeown joined Zoe Cummins, and she wanted us to think, no, really think, about shoes.
The prompt asked writers to think about three pairs of shoes that they'd owned and to associate, to free associate around the memories that those pairs of shoes, which might come from various, could come from childhood, could be from when they were in secondary school, or it could be something from an occasion or just a memory in adulthood. Then to free associate around that, to make a list of memories, associations, impressions, and to write from one of those lists, to write a scene. And it's always been really productive.
And there's something about shoes, you know, the texture, but also there's movement in shoes, isn't there? Your feet are taking you somewhere.
Well, yeah, I mean, shoes are what bring us to the most important and least important events in our lives, you know, as long as we don't go barefoot. They hold so much. I mean, they hold class connotations. They hold our identities, our sense, our ideas about ourselves. They can hold pride. They can hold shame. They can tell stories about our families. They can tell stories about what we're hoping for and what we're afraid of. They can be uncomfortable. They can be practical or they can be ridiculous. They really do tell a lot of story.
And we all find it very, very hard to throw them out as well.
Right. And they contain our imprint.
Such a lot to think about as we look down at the runners. And over on Lyric, another invitation to look again and listen anew. What do you hear when you simply stop and listen? Not to music or a conversation, but just to the sounds, every sound around you. Culturefile brought us this.
Kate Carr is my name, and I'm a field recording practitioner based in London. I have one spot I really like in London. It's a great location for just listening, which is Blackfriars Station, which is on the Thames. And it just sounds amazing when the tide is coming in and the river is rushing up against the gritty, rocky kind of foreshore of the Thames. There's often buskers there as well. It's usually more to the, I suppose, posher end of busking in that area because it's kind of near to the Tate and whatnot. So you might have someone playing a violin, and the trains themselves make their own kind of whine and whistle. And actually, I love that sound when the trains are coming and the rail starts to sing, but all with the bustle and the echo of people walking on a train station.
And this is one of her favourite sounds.
It's
the sound of a drain on the bank of the Thames. And the Thames is super tidal, so as it rushes in and out, in this particular instance, this drain sounded so strongly like it was breathing. Yeah, I had recorded it for ages. I just sat there like, oh my God, it's the breathing drain. So I loved that sound. And just the ideas that it's able to convey about cities and our structures and this idea of kind of a living infrastructure that we all are participating in certain ways, or that the infrastructure itself takes on these human characteristics, at least in our own imagination. So I love that one.
And she is also a bit of a fan of leaving in the sounds that the rest of us might edit out. Mic rattle, thumps, the bad stuff.
Sometimes I don't always love these glitches of recording practice, you know, the wind noise that distorts everything, or you drop the mic and it makes a dreadful sound or something like this. But I do occasionally like to also include them as kind of that gesture towards the act of recording itself.
And that, in a kind of a roundabout way, brings us to BP Fallon. He spoke to Ray on Thursday. Radio Horror Story.
When you interviewed John Lennon and Yoko Ono. Everybody's So regrettably,
that's completely now. So
yes, you, I know.
You,
yeah,
give
yeah.
peace a chance.
Yeah,
that was done in Canada. I went to the Amsterdam, which was the first one. Yeah,
yeah.
I just arrived and on the house.
And what were you at the time? How were you describing yourself?
Chancellor, I suppose.
Right,
you know.
Okay.
Because it's all ad lib, everything, you know.
So you got this interview, and it's the radio reporter's nightmare, and it happened to you.
Yes. I went back to these people I was staying with, the hog farm, hippies, you know, wavy gravy and all of that. Listen to this, John Lennon. Batteries were flat, you know.
I know.
So you either jump out the window, or you do what I did, which is I rang up John Lennon, and I said, look, you know, all that stuff we did today, it was very good, wasn't it? Yes, it was very good, but it didn't come out. Can you come around tomorrow? So we did more.
Yeah.
And then the stuff that was at the wrong speed, I met a chap.
Triggering. BP Fallon with Ray. Now, cast your mind back. Those heady Celtic Tiger days, the money, the helicopters, the shopping trips. And of course, we didn't all party, but we might have thumbed the glossier pages of those Sunday supplements, gawping at those who did. Step up, Gavin Lamurphy, grabbed by the scruff of his designer shirt and back on the airwaves once more.
I haven't been on the radio, in studio on the radio, since Jerry Ryan, so it's a very long time.
Okay. Oh, it's a different world. And now, as he hurtles towards his 50th birthday, the It Boy is back with a new concept store, or shop, as we can also call it. But he was happy enough to talk about the crazy years.
You were at every high-profile launch, and there were many of them at the time, weren't there?
Crazy.
Parties,
yeah.
Models holding up strange objects in the street.
I know.
And I was even looking at pictures to see just like what was your brand at the time. And you know you're holding champagne in nearly every photograph.
Every photograph, I'm holding champagne.
And it's weirdly a hotel bedroom for reasons.
Yeah, there was always a lot of hotel bedrooms.
I think we don't understand that time, and we're hoping that you can now transport us.
Answers on a postcard, RTE Donnybrook 4.
What the hell was going on?
I don't know. I mean, the whole thing was so bizarre that you were doing. For an example, I met the photographer for the Sunday Times yesterday. I hadn't seen him for 20 years, and he used to follow me around every week to do what we were doing, and we were laughing, saying, Ireland then, some weeks you'd have, we can pick any celebrity because everybody's in town. And then the next week we'd have zilch. And we go, what are we going to do? So get a good looking girl and stand beside her or lie in a bed in a hotel room. I don't know what we were trying, what it was meant to be. But like a lot of it was just, I don't know, you know, as you said, a lot of champagne holding.
These days, it's all clean living. Although he does take a drink, but very measured. And in keeping with the new Ireland.
the whole culture has changed. Like, my nephew is 16, and I spoke to him recently. We went to the Shelburne, had lunch, and I said to him, like, you know, are you going to have a glass of wine? And he was like, no. And I thought he meant because, you know, I'm young. And he said, no, because I don't drink. I only drink Evian water. And I was like, okay. But he said, none of my friends drink. So there is that new generation of people who are probably more interested in looking well on Instagram or TikTok or whatever, and they're not interested in looking wasted. Like, let's be clear, if there was a camera phone back when I was doing what I was doing,
Oh my God, that'd be hard to get over.
Evian at the Shelburne. But he's not above being just a little past remarkable. His partner lives in Monte Carlo.
What's happening in Monte Carlo these days? Is it?
Oh, the same old, you know. Everyone's got a new face and a new Bentley. It's just about it, you know. And then you go to lunch. Some days when I'm down there, I go out to lunch and I'm sitting with, waiting for the other half to arrive or whatever. And that guy was, again, quite funny. Two women arrived recently at a restaurant, sat at the table next to me. And I kind of sat there looking at them going, who's the mother and who's the daughter? Because there is that fine line when you get the work done. You know, it's like, and my other half is a cosmetic surgeon.
Must be great people watching.
It's kind of fun.
He does plastic surgery.
He is a full cosmetic surgeon.
What's hot in that world?
I have no idea. I could tell you, but I'd have to tell you offline or off air, I mean. But I mean, you know, it's just funny. I could say, so I say to him, because a lot of his clients would be friends of ours. And I'd say, my God, will you stop doing that to her face? And he'd go, I can't, the darling. She wants it. She loves it. I'm like, stop. Her face is going to explode. But it's very, as you know, talking about addiction, cosmetic surgery is a serious addiction.
Oh, big.
Because it's, and it's also that
once
famous.
Once you start meddling.
It's a Picasso, you know. You have to keep putting bits back on Mr. Potato Head, you know. So, but you do see some sights down there because obviously more money, more problems, more surgery. So it's.
Oh, with problems like those. Gavin Lamb-Murphy with Oliver. Now we are almost at a finish here on Playback. Donal Deneen was in on Lyric for Blue of the Night and brought us this.
Nature is definitely peaking at the moment. The ditches are popping and the flat of the land has the crop down on it. What's he on about? Oh yeah, that summer feeling.
When you run for love, not because you oughta. When you trust your friends with no reason, nada. The joy I've named shall not be tamed. And that summer feeling is gonna haunt you one day in your life.
And that is it from this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
When the cool of the pond makes you drop